Chapter 12. New Love. In a family therapy session with my mother, when I was a child, the therapist discussed resilience. "It is a measure of how well you are able to cope with trauma," he said. "Some people naturally have more resilience. Some people have very little." My mother turned to me rapidly without prompting. "You're not very resilient," she said, laughing. When I was a baby, I slept quietly through the night. My mother said I was so easy that she wasn't prepared for my younger brother, who was more prone to crying. I told my mother I thought I was very resilient. All of my life, people have told me I was timid, shy, afraid, unable to get anything done, despite great potential, that I never tried quite hard enough, that I was weak. That same therapist, later on, told me I had a powerful voice. "You speak like you are someone much older," he said. "You speak with authority. When you speak, people listen. It is like you have a powerful voice behind you." So much of recovering from trauma is learning to trust yourself again. It's only when you trust yourself and your ability to make decisions that you can feel safe. Some people are shocked when they see me become firm and at how firm I can be. Once I was at a college party with my girlfriend at the time. There were two men, older, mid to late 20s, who were giving her vodka. "Do you want some?" he asked, proffering a cup in my direction. "No," I said, cold. They were cute, but they were acting rude. My girlfriend was in a sexy dress with her hair done, and I was in sweatpants and a t-shirt looking like a dyke. They talked my girlfriend into going into a private room with them, and she asked me to come along. I considered myself bisexual, but my girlfriend strongly identified as a lesbian. One of the guys started kissing her, the other started kissing me. I bit him. "I don't want to have sex with you," I said, and turned to my girlfriend, asking, "Do you want to be here?" "It's fine," she said. "Do you want to go?" I nodded. One of the men tried to stop us from going, picking me up, trying to kiss me, and I bit him again, drawing blood. "Fucking bitch," he said. I walked my girlfriend home. Along the way, a cop car pulled up beside us on the street. "Are you ladies from Sarah Lawrence?" one of them said, leering, with that mixture of condescension and perversion older men reserve for queer women. My girlfriend cheerily told them we were, and they drove off. We went back to the dorm room, and she lay on my bed. "Thank you," she said. I told her I was happy to try a three-way with a man with her if she wanted, but I wanted her to be sober when we picked him, at least. She was beautiful, still is, of course, and men were always annoyed at my presence. Cock block. She loved it, being able to flirt with them freely, asking me to play the possessive girlfriend so she would never have to follow through on anything she didn't feel comfortable with. My mom and I have a much better relationship than we did when I was younger. Now she has given up trying to control me in any way, understanding that any attempts to do so will just drive me further away. She is still uncomfortable about sex, so when we talk about my work, we always step around the nitty-gritty of it in our conversations. She still dislikes my job and wishes I was doing something banal and safe. A small, tidy office job. I sent her an article about how sex workers are treated by the church, and she agreed. All should be welcome. Another day, I joked, "I've been loving using QuickBooks. I've been thinking about quitting to be an accountant." "Oh, I would like that," she said. I think perhaps we have different definitions of welcoming and acceptance. What is unconditional love? What is the lesson in the story of the prodigal son returning home? I feel so proud of my work, of my success, and it stings that my mother doesn't see it that way. I think if it was nearly any other career, she would be immensely proud of me. I feel loved, but misunderstood. When I first told my sister I do sex work, her first question was, "Are you happy?" And when I told her I was happier than I had ever been, she said that was all she cared about. I have a few sex worker friends whose families are unbothered, accepting, or even encouraging of their sex work activities. For many, though, their relationships with their families are incredibly fraught, especially with regard to their work. Of course, some parents would never be proud of their children, no matter how successful and accomplished they were. I have friends who are leaders in their field, who have been blessed with incredible financial success, marriage, and children, whose parents still darkly criticize them at every turn. For friends who aren't American, sex work is often viewed a little differently. When I work in Hong Kong, I notice my clients from mainland China have vastly different attitudes towards sex work. I asked one of my clients about it. He told me that it was not considered shameful or emasculating to pay for sex, but instead it was a sign of success and virility. While most people probably wouldn't want their daughter to become a sex worker, it wasn't necessarily a sign of shame. It just wasn't a prestigious job like being a doctor. Being a quote-unquote gold digger, dating a man for his money and prestige, is considered only natural. Most of my friends hide their work from their families, afraid of the shame or condemnation, afraid of rejection or judgment. They craft complex backstories of teaching yoga or running a made-up business, running around to scatter little bits of truth that add credibility to these stories. Some even work secondary jobs, not because they want to, but just so that no one will know. I hid my work from my mother for years, telling her I still worked in tech. Whenever someone would press for more information, I would just tell them I had signed a strict NDA and couldn't discuss it further. My mother never pressed too hard, but I held her at arm's length. A few years ago, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I broke down crying. I didn't want her to die not knowing who I was. I realized how badly I wanted a real relationship with her. I decided I would have to tell her, but I spent years dithering about it, trying to figure out the best way to say the words. Every time we would meet up, I would resolve to tell her, only to have the words freeze on my tongue. Eventually, I wrote an article talking about how I wanted to tell her, but how I was afraid to say anything. I think some part of me felt like having it published would make her take me more seriously, show I was still someone deserving of respect, that I wasn't throwing my life away or acting foolish, that this was a real career for me. Instead of telling her directly how I felt, I sent her a link to the article. She responded later that day, asking me something like if I wanted to meet up for my brother's birthday, then a link to a cute animal video. I asked her what she thought about what I sent, and she said she was thinking about it. A few days later, she responded, saying she didn't love what I was doing, but she still loved me. I have a pet theory that she went to a therapy session in between when I sent the message and when she responded, workshopping the response. I asked my tarot cards what I needed to write about in this book. I've been using them lately for friends who are writing novels, helping them unravel the position of their character, pointing the plot home. I drew the tower and the lovers stuck together. The tower is the card of destruction, rapid and overwhelming change, an institution torn down, but always something that needed to be torn down. In the deck I was using, it shows a medieval tower, the type a storybook princess might be trapped in, struck by a bolt of lightning. The lovers have an image that might evoke Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Harmony and love, perhaps the idea of innocence. As a child, I sometimes felt that where my heart was, there was a great gaping hole, a black hole that sucked everything in, and when I was upset, it felt like this hole was ripped open, raw, incredibly painful. It was the sort of pain I knew not to tell my doctor about. I believed I was adopted for many years, despite having a resemblance to both of my parents. When I was in fourth grade or so, I came across a folder of my ultrasounds, tucked into a bookshelf. I looked through it silently, then put it back where I found it. My parents had suffered many miscarriages before my birth, one of them on Mother's Day. My father described picking up champagne and roses for my mother, on her last Mother's Day, not a mother, and bringing them home to her, only to find her lying in bed, crying. I told my mother once that it wasn't right that my father yelled when he was mad, and she shrugged, helpless. That's just how men are. There are so many ways to talk about things falling apart. I have this idea of capturing them like slow motion breaking glass, a type of video I used to watch on YouTube. People act as though the internet has soiled children's minds, introducing them to pornography. And I think of my clients who tell me they first saw a naked woman in their father's hidden stash of Playboys, hidden in the closet. What secrets would people find before nudie magazines? As a child, I was always searching for secrets. I don't anymore, at least not in the same way. Where would I look? I have no closets to snoop through but my own. Perhaps that is the same urge that drives us to gossip about celebrities or anyone who is a bit of microfame. Tearing down that image of someone revered as if by rote, as we learn to do with our own parents. After the pain of destruction comes healing. Wounds that lurk under the surface can go septic or explode. Sometimes we need surgery to go underneath and dig up a darkened mass so we can heal. I think the hardest part about growing up, at least for me, was accepting that there is no perfect love and absolutes are rare. I was always such a perfectionist, refusing to turn in homework assignments unless they passed my impossible standards. My father and his binary nature no doubt played a major role in this. He was all or nothing and his thinking bled into mine. I wanted my life to run like a perfect computer program, with crystal clear logic, no bugs, completely efficient, pure. But of course, that's an impossibility, and given my medical conditions and how they interfered with my abilities, I was forced to confront earlier than most that I could not consistently perform at a level of complete perfection, that in fact, no one could. It's a lesson I'm still learning. Perhaps I've never really changed, I just take it all less seriously. My parents are imperfect, as are my friends, my lovers, my colleagues, my clients. I think, even after my disillusionment with myself, I still clung to the idea that others could be perfect for me. This blinded me when people hurt me, turned my feelings about others black and white. I couldn't see that someone could be complex, and that sometimes the harm they caused could outweigh the kindness they offered, or vice versa. For so long, I was so desperate to be in control that I couldn't let myself believe that I was being manipulated. It is only in recent years that I have finally been learning to stop, to breathe, to try to look at the situation with an unbiased eye, to see gray and gradients of color where previously I might have only seen black and white, to forgive myself if I trusted someone who hurt me. My mother is by no means perfect, a statement I think she would agree with. It still hurts me that she doesn't fully see me, but she loves me and she is learning to care for me in the ways I need. I am fascinated by reading online conspiracy theories that say humanity was never meant to eat, that the idea of eating food is a distraction from God. People write about fasting for months and its benefits, or people like Jordan Peterson, who adhere to an all-red meat diet, which fixed all that ailed him. He completely forgot to mention that a significant part of his diet was benzodiazepines. He recently had a doctor-induced coma in Moscow so that he could sleep through the withdrawal. I wonder if they gave him a meat slurry through his feeding tube so he can maintain the health benefits of his all-meat diet, now sans benzos. My brother loves Jordan Peterson. I will gently poke fun at Peterson when we hang out, poking holes in his grotesque flailing against the vague threat of postmodernism. I ask my brother if he has ever read Foucault, and he shakes his head. He wants a YouTube video to consume, one that will tell him about ancient mysteries and the confirmed identity of the Antichrist. According to his favorite theorist, it's Prince Charles. I think so much of the work that needs to be done by white leftists is in our own families. In some ways, it's easier to go to a protest and shout or post memes to share with our already hip friends. Family is triggering. But my brother knows I love him, regardless of his vote for Trump, and that I'm not telling him my political beliefs for no reason. He knows I'm not stupid. He listens, and of course he doesn't agree with everything, but he thinks about it. He knows I used to be very conservative. So much of what is wrong with our society is the focus on the duality of absolute good and absolute evil. It infects nearly all of our discourse, justifying everything from the carceral justice system to cancel culture. I'm suspicious of anyone who claims to have a perfect understanding of how humans should live, how to be a quote-unquote good person. The reality is that absolutes are few and far between, and we humans are rarely capable of perceiving them clearly. It is important to see that there are almost always gradients of harm and care. Often they are quite mixed up amongst each other. For a long time, I considered whether or not I should become vegan. It was something that disturbed me immensely, that my life necessitated the death of others. I then considered the life of a plant. Should I consider the life of a stalk of corn over that of a chicken? Do I value the chicken more because it expresses pain in a way that is similar to mine? Do I value my life over the life of the chicken, or the life of the corn, or the life of the bugs which may have eaten the corn had I not? The answer, ultimately, is that I do. The corn stalk values its access to sunlight over the smaller plants around it. It chooses to consume and to live. For so long, this seemed incredibly bleak to me, that we necessarily caused death and pain by our own living. One day more recently, I meditated on these thoughts after taking 5 grams of mushrooms. I looked at my dog and thought about how I would rather have her eat me than ever have to eat her to survive. How could I treat any other living being differently? We must give love to the corn and the chicken, knowing one day we will kill them. And when we do kill them, we must do it in a way that minimizes their pain, fear, and suffering, to avoid wasting their death by cooking them with love and care, to celebrate them and thank them for their sacrifice. We are continuously learning about ourselves. While there are those who hurt others without a second thought, most people want to participate in caring for a community. When building any sort of habit, you need to give yourself space to make mistakes as you learn. This is true about changing habits and ending addictions, as well as changing political beliefs. The first step towards ending racism, sexism, and classism is to accept that everyone, to varying degrees, holds problematic views and biases. Most humans have a strong desire to learn and grow. We just need to nurture it. A few months ago, I went on a hike with my mother. She seems so much calmer than she ever was. She laughs and moves with less of that tension, as though she is a violin, tuned to a lower pitch, strings vibrating at a lower frequency, less shrill. The card I drew next was the star, which follows the tower in the major arcana. The star shows a woman beneath 8 stars, pulling 1 jug of water into a lake, with another on the ground. It is a card of healing, of restoration. She places 1 foot in the water, the other on the ground. My interest in the occult began when I was a child reading fairy tales. Witches and wizards, good and evil, though sometimes thought to be good was evil, and sometimes it was the other way around. Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time had a dramatic impact on me. I read all of her books. I checked them out in a massive stack from the library and tore through them ravenously, like someone who had not tasted food before. She wrote about love. In one of the books, the main character, Meg, must rescue her much-hated teacher. She is told she needs to name him, to find some part of him to love, or he will be consumed by the darkness. She comes to see that he is not what she hated of him. She sees his pain and his small daily kindnesses. I used to think my mother hated me and wanted me to suffer, that she loved my brother more than she loved me, that she would never protect me. My father told me when I was older that she always felt he got in the way of our relationship, that he drove us apart. For better or for worse, those books taught me that love always prevails. not just romantic love, but love in the religious sense, in the Jesus read text in the Bible sense. I have always tried to push through that darkness, to find that hurt child inside the person hurting me, hold their hand and walk them out of the fog. The messier adult truth is that not everyone wants to take those steps with you. Some people will stay with their feet planted down in misery. It's a cliche, of course, but people need to want to change. Rock bottom or no, there's no predicting it. I always thought my father would be able to love me the way that I needed, that he could grow to be the father I needed and move past his faults. He has sunken deep into YouTube and talk radio world, ranting about Jesus and Trump, conspiracy theories. The kind and nurturing father I knew seems gone entirely. It turned out my mother was the one who grew for me. She was always trying to hold my hand, but I never felt it. She always took me to the doctor, but she trusted the doctor over me. She read all the parenting books about how to raise a child. She was always trying to learn, to be better. As I learned more about articulating my needs, and she learned more about loving herself, she learned how to love me as well. The hike ended at the top of some old mountain. The air was humid, and we were sweating and panting in the heat. We looked down at the view, pointed out different buildings, small and far away. A train cut its way through the landscape, too far away for us to hear it. "Do you want some water?" she asked, handing me a bottle. "Sure," I said, sitting down and gulping. I set the bottle down in between my legs and rested. The sun shimmered on the lake down below. I wiped some sweat off my forehead. "How are you feeling?" she asked, looking at me expectantly. "Good," I said, smiling back at her.